local and on a national level. We have a parliament. We have a independent judiciary.
Sure.
And an elected president, executive. And then above this whole system, which is, and the system being a way in which the people are participating in their lives, in their political life, in their social life, in their economic life, in the decision makings that affect them, on top of this system, as a person who is able to guide it, who's able to steer it in the right direction, who's able to prevent it from, you know, going to either extreme, we have a supreme leader.
Exactly.
And who, as you know, we were mentioning, is a religious person.
Exactly. And the fact is that the Constitution reflects that, doesn't it?
Exactly. And so this is something when we had, you know, as we've seen in history, we've had a person like, you know, Imam Khomeini.
Yes.
And after Imam, we have Ayatollah Khamenei, who's the leader. Yeah. Now, I'm saying all this, and what I'm trying to point out is that let's look at what the alternatives have been.
Yes, I mean,
and what effect this has had on the societies, on the politics.
What we still have today in the Middle East. I mean, this is the real issue, isn't it?
But not only in the Middle East.
Yeah.
If we look at it, because we were talking about the crisis in the West,
but of course, you know,
right,
regionally,
exactly. You know, these are things that when you talk about it, that it's really, you know, I think if you put aside prejudice and if you put aside some of the you know, brainwashing that people get in
the
West,
propaganda, basically,
and the propaganda, you will see that it has been to the benefit of Iran,
yes,
to have this kind of leadership.
To have a jurist in control.
To have a system of elite family, it's been to the benefit. And I'm talking about benefit materially.
Mm.
You know, by those standards which, you know, politicians and politics and political systems and economic systems are measured.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
That's a very, very significant
this is the point.
Yeah.
So putting that aside for a second, we can come back to that in terms of looking at the positive side of it. Let's look at the negative side of it.
Right.
I'm talking about the West now.
For
example, you have a system, and we've talked about this many times before in different programs, where, for example, in the States, in the United States, you have a leadership, you have an elite who is not capable of defending and pursuing the interests of the United States, of the people of the United States.
No, they're not. Yeah, that's right. Yes.
Whether it's the economic interests.
What happened to those three words that were so pronounced in the U.S. Constitution, we the people?
Right. And this is the point, which is that they pursue the elite interests.
Yes.
They pursue very narrow corporate interests.
Yes. And that's 1/10 of 1%.
Right. And then they come on TV and they're like, well, it's to your benefit.
It's to your benefit.
So this is the difference. Mm.
They're dictating to the people.
And these are supposed to be the higher level, you know, statesmen, the president, you know.
Yeah.
Forget about the local guys. I mean, it's all about, you know, money and, you know, who has the
wealth,
most money and, you know, campaigning based on, you know, attack ads. And I mean, it's just completely dirty, you know. So we're talking, you know, we're not even talking about that aspect of it, which is, you know, forget about that.
Yes.
We're talking about leadership.
Leadership, yeah.
We're talking
about, actual qualities that are required in an individual.
You know, we have a situation, and it wasn't always like this in the West.
No. They had statesmen.
Right. They had good leaders.
Yes.
You know, I always talk about De Gaulle in France.
In France, yes.
Being an example of a pretty good leader.
Yeah.
You know, for that society.
Yes.
Having moral courage, you know, standing up
for the French interest.
Right, and, you know, just basically being a person who...
A patriot.
Right, and being kind of selfless and not really trying to, you know, play politics in the
absolutely.
You know,
this goes down well with the Scottish. You know,
right.
We understand that concept very
well.
We'll
see if we have to add Alex Salmon to that. But,
but
he seems to be doing a good job, so, you know. I mean, of course, De Gaulle having the war and, you know, liberation of France and so on.
But
I mean, so
you're quite right, sir, because there weren't many good statesmen.
Right,
no doubt,
people talk about Churchill, you know.
Churchill, yes.
We can argue that. I mean, I don't think he was really a good leader in the sense that during the war, he, you know, he did what he had to do, which is to, you know, fight the war.
Yeah.
But other things, I think.
But he tops the poll as far as
all I'm saying is that in terms of being a leader during the war.
He was very effective.
But, you know, there are a lot of major things that were horrible about, you know, what he did.
Throughout his career. There was a lot of criminal things,
including chemical weapons.
Chemical weapons used on Kurds, you know, which brings back memories of 1990.
Right.
Yeah.
So you know, But the point I'm trying to make is that, you know, we really have a crisis in the West.
That's right.
In terms of leadership,
we moral
right.
And
I mean, if you look at the quality of, let's say, U.S. presidents.
Yes, yes. Why did it decline towards the evolutionary scale of Darwinism? That instead of, you know, man evolving from apes, it went from man to ape.
Right. I mean, these are things that are, you know, it's a problem because, I mean, if you look at, I don't know, you know, if you want to look at it from a, you know, sympathetic perspective, you know, you had people like Eisenhower. Okay, I mean,
yes, I mean, Dwight,
you know, we don't really like him here because he, you know, did the coup. But the point I'm trying to make is that,
but
you know,
he was a very effective.
But
president.
You know, in for U.S. standards, he was pretty good.
He was a very good statesman. Yes,
you know, or if you look at somebody like, you know, I would even say Nixon compared to some of the people that we have these days. You know, we're not talking about the domestic things.
Yeah,
but internationally, you know, had a strategic,
Nixon went to China,
right? Started a strategic vision. You know, tried to end the Vietnam War. You know,
sure.
Did a lot of things.
He lived up to some aspects.
Right.
Of
there was a feeling there that you felt like there was something beyond themselves.
Exactly.
There was something beyond just narrow, you know, special interests that they were pursuing.
That's very.
And
good,
a lot of them would even stand up to certain streams within their own party and within their own political movement in order to do what they thought was right for the country. So these are rare, and it just doesn't happen anymore.
No,
you know, if you just look across the board, if you look at one of these EU, you know, summits, or if you look at one of these, you know, G20 summits and whatever, I mean, how many of these people would you consider to be statesmen? How many of them would you consider to be moral leaders?
Exactly.
Because it's really about moral leadership.
Exactly. My question to you, Dr. Tarabi, is this: is it deliberate?
Well, what I'm trying to say is that, you know, the whole idea of moral leadership is completely out the window in the West.
Yeah.
You know, we have this idea. The reason why we have, you know,
is that just a generational decline?
Well, I think it's something you make fun of now. It's not.
I think so. Yeah.
You know, it's like you say, "Well, we need a moral leader." Like, yeah, get out of here. What are you talking about? You know.
Yeah.
Whereas in Islam, the whole point of a leader is that he is the moral compass.
Exactly, because we have to live up to the standards of the Sharia.
And Quran and try to live according to the way, you know, Allah wants us to. So we need a person who himself
is a model.
Is a moral embodiment of that.
Yeah.
So this is the difference when we talk about, for example, in Shiism, we're insisting on the imams. An imam means, you know, leader. It means leader.
It literally means leader.
When we insist on the imams being the leaders of Islam, as opposed to, you know, the khalifas or whatever other views there were, it's because they were not only, they were also the embodiments of those values of Islam that they were trying to implement.
Absolutely.
So it wasn't, didn't have this problem of people talking about Islam, but they themselves being, you know, unjust people.
That's a very good point that you're raising.
And it's an ayah in the Quran.
Yes.
It talks about, you know, those who enjoin others or those who command others to justice, and they are just themselves.
To do good, to do righteousness, that's
And they are just themselves.
Yeah. Yes. This is
the difference.
This is the contradiction, isn't it? Because this is the crisis that we're really talking about in the West, that the leaders who, you know, espouse human rights and who, you know, give all kinds of niceties or pleasantries about all sorts of things, but
things that nobody would disagree with.
Nobody would disagree, but they don't live up to those.
Well,
personal,
of course not.
In their
not only
and
do they
private
not live
life,
up to
them, they're as corrupt and rotten to the core.
Right. It's not only that they don't live up to it; it's exactly the opposite.
It's sheer hypocrisy.
Right. They talk about, you know, human rights and human dignity, and they go around killing people around the world.
Exactly.
What I'm trying to say is that this goes back to moral character. Things like moral character, things like an ethical life.
Sure.
Things like, you know, having a personal ethical standard for yourself, which, again, it's not even so much that they don't, it's beyond the fact that they don't have it anymore. It's like something that you make fun of now. Mm. Whereas in Islam, and, you know, alhamdulillah, thank God we have Walayat Faqih. Thank God we have Walayat Faqih.
Thanks to the school of Ahlul Bayt.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and it really, if anybody doubts this, they should come to Iran and they should see it themselves, what a positive effect this has. Whether it's in terms of, you know, keeping the ship, you know, on course,
yes.
And whether it's on the left or on the right, trying to, you know, go to either extreme, you have that leadership. Whether it's about, you know, raising those basic issues in society and pointing out those problems if the governments are not doing their job, or if certain things that are going amiss is mentioned by the Supreme Leader, or whether it's encouraging certain things. I'll give you a very clear example.
Please.
If you look at the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, during his tenure and during the time that he's been the Supreme Leader, his focus has been on the thing that he's been, you know, constantly talking about and making a priority is scientific advancement.
Exactly.
And knowledge and building a scientific society in terms of having, you know, Iran advance when it comes to all sorts of knowledge, whether it's technical and scientific in terms of the hard sciences or whether it's, you know, humanities or whatever subjects there are.
Yeah, whatever fields there are, yeah, absolutely.
And you see an incredible thing happening in these 20 years in Iran, which is you have a country which is very backward, you know, 40 years ago in terms of science, doesn't have its own, you know, scientific life, really. It's just a place where theories, you know, developed other places are imitated. Or worse, where, you know, when it comes to technical things, and you're an engineer.
Yes,
you know, bringing in foreign engineers.
But thank you for reminding me.
Bringing in foreign engineers to do very simple tasks.
That's right.
So we have this massive transformation happening in Iran because it is insisted upon by the leader.
Mm.
And it is insisted in the sense that he says that when the governments come and whoever is going to come, and doesn't matter from which side of the political spectrum, and, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, who it is, a priority has to be the scientific advancement of the society. And we see incredible advancements.
Of course.
Things that are acknowledged by the different, you know, non-governmental organizations which, you know, are working in this field globally, which have nothing to do with Iran, and, you know, there's no need for them to try to...
And the fact
you
that
know, talking about this, how advanced Iran has become. So this is one example of when you have a leadership that comes and says to whoever is the government, it's fine, you do those things that you promised and the things that you...
Yeah, to run the affairs
of
the
state. But these things have to be set in society.
Sorry.
I'll give you another example.
Mm.
The idea of taking care of the poor and the weak.
Mm. Yes, we're talking about welfare.
You know, we have this thing in the West where, you know, it's just become... I mean, this goes back to Thatcher and Reagan. And,
oh, of course it does.
You know, these guys that they're like, oh, you know, you don't want to take care of the poor anymore.
No.
Or you don't care about the poor anymore. Or it's their fault that they're poor.
Yes.
You know, and so of course there's been abuse of the welfare system and so on. We're not denying that, but you know, the basic idea that you would help the weaker members of society,
and that's a measure, you know, of
things
civilization.
Like, you know,
isn't
elderly
it?
People who worked their whole life, who are maybe now not capable of working that
that's
much.
Right.
You know, we're not talking
about
people,
and they're entitled to certain rights.
Yeah, we're not talking
and
about people
benefits.
who are you know, just lazy bums who are not doing anything. We're talking about people who work 30, 40, 50 years,
and they're entitled to something at the end of the day.
You got to take care of them.
Yes,
we're talking about people who are maybe physically disabled or who are mentally disabled. We're not talking about, you know. So these are things that, in a society which has a moral leadership, which has a leader that bases his, you know, actions and his speeches and the way he guides society on a certain set ethical moral framework, these things are not going to be put aside in a society because somebody got the vote and, you know, they're going to come in and they're going to change everything, you know, from top to bottom and whatever. So, you know, this is what we're talking about.
Mm.
We're talking about that there are certain things in every society, whether you're talking about the, you know, Islamic society or in the East or in the West or in Europe, that require a moral leader to maintain it.
Yes.
To safeguard it.
Mm.
To not allow those dynamics that happen in every society
to decline or to be...
Right.
Yeah.
And this is one of the great values.
Mm.
I would also like to point out this. This is something that some of the, you know, even Western experts talk about, which is that when you have a leadership, as you have in the West, which is so a result, a derivative, a consequence of money and moneyed interests and special interests, well, that's not really a leadership. You know, you don't have honest leadership.
No.
You know what I mean?
Or visionary leadership.
Right. You don't have a person taking chances. You don't have a person... as you were saying very correctly, you know, presenting a vision.
Yeah.
It's always tactics. It's always politics. How are we going to get to the next election?
It's the short term now.
Right. How are we going to get to the next elections? Mm. How is this going to play out in the media? Yeah. How is this going to work out, you know, with Congress?
With the greatest profitability for my backers or my supporters.
Exactly. Yeah. Or my party or whatever.
Or my party, yes.
Whereas if you have a leadership like Welet Feli, which is above these matters.
Exactly.
Which is what some of the people, when they talk about the king having a royal system, you know, like those who advocate constitutional monarchy.
Constitutional
monarchy, like in Britain or in some of the Western European countries.
And we still haven't got a constitution.
Right.
Here we are.
The problem with that and the difference is this. Yes, I agree in principle that a good king can have that function in a society.
He does, yes.
Or
that's
a queen,
true.
Right?
That's true.
But unfortunately what we see is that these kings and queens are not really... they're
cool. Yeah.
Because they're... you see, this is the difference between having a religious leadership...
Based on merit.
On merit. Mm. A scholar, a faqih, somebody who has...
qualified for
right,
that.
Who has struggled themselves to get to this both intellectual and academic position and also moral and spiritual position. Because this is a moral and spiritual... You have to have that level of it as well in order to be able to guide a society.
Right.
You know, you can't just be some, you know, whatever, you know, guy that just comes along and gets the votes and, okay, well, I'm going to, you know, I'm going to be the moral leader now. You know, you have to work on yourself, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
And again, age is also maybe not necessarily, it doesn't have to be an old person. It could be like, you know,
Berlusconi wouldn't qualify.
Right, exactly. You know what I mean? I mean, I'll give you an example. You know, this new Pope, Pope Francis, you know, he's saying good things.
Yes.
You know, he's saying nice things. Yeah. We like what he's saying, you know, about the poor and helping the poor and, you know,
bringing those
not being so, you know, ostentatious, the church not being so ostentatious and so on.
Yes.
I mean, we have issues when it comes to celibacy and...
Yeah, other issues.
There are other issues.
Yeah, yes, true.
But, you know, this is what I'm talking about.
Exactly.
I'm talking about somebody who was a little bit above this, who was above the fray.
Yes.
Okay, the kings were supposed to do that. The queens were supposed to do that.
To do that.
Well, they're not doing that.
No.
They basically become, you know, these rich elites that, you know...
Exactly. They're, you know, they're part and parcel
running
of the
around
same game.
On the jet set and, you know, you know, going on ski vacations and going
That's
on Caribbean
right.
vacations.
And costing the taxpayer enormous amount of
money. So these are not, you know... In principle, when those that defend monarchy in those countries or constitutional monarchy, when they talk about that, yes, the principle is correct that you would have somebody above the fray. But what we see historically is that none of that has happened.
No.
When was the last time you had a king who was morally... you know, leading the country.
Sure.
And you know, setting
I can't recall one, put it that way. Yes.
Right. I mean, maybe 100 years ago, 200 years ago, something. But
something,
you know,
maybe down the line,
right.
Yes.
And again, the difference is that when you have a royal system that's based on, you know, hereditary monarchy.
Monarchy, yeah.
You know, which is kind of a lottery, right?
Yes.
We always talk about that.
That's right, yes, right, yes.
You know, a certain kind of lottery, you know, depending on, you know, who... you know, your father and your mother.
Yes, Prince Charles still weeps.
Right,
yes.
So, you know, these are things that obviously are going to affect that leadership as opposed to, you know, as you were explaining, a system in which a person is chosen based on their own merits.
On their own merits,
and
yes.
Remember, the supreme leader is somebody that comes and is chosen. It's an indirect election.
Yes.
The people elect the Assembly of Experts.
And the experts.
And the Assembly of Experts. You know, appoint, select a supreme leader.
Supreme leader.
And they're able to, you
sure,
know,
sure.
Which you can't, I mean, with a king, what are you going to do? You can't impeach a king, right?
No, you can't. Yes. I remember that since Charles I.
Right. Yes. So, you know, this is a problem with having kings is, you know, once you got them, you got them.
You can't get rid of them until death do us part.
How long has, you know, Elizabeth been around? I mean,
oh, she's been around for a long time. You know, this is why Charles weeps, you know. He really cries, you know. He wants mother off that throne as soon as possible,
right.
You know.
So, you know, this is what we're talking about. We haven't even mentioned places like, you know, Saudi Arabia. We haven't mentioned places.
It's our favorite topic. But
you know,
we haven't
mentioned like Azerbaijan hereditary presidency.
Their hereditary line doesn't go that far back.
So I would categorize them. I mean, obviously Saudi Arabia is a monarchy, but I mean, I would categorize, you know, it's the same principle that we're talking about.
Exactly, that's true.
But the unfortunate thing is that you have in the West a society and a civilization which actually did value moral leadership at some point.
At some point, that's true.
You know, where you have examples of that in its history where you really had people. And, of course, you have it in the East as well. You have it, you know, we were talking about one of the Khalifas, which was, you know, Omar bin Abdul Aziz, who was considered one of the good Khalifa. You know, this is something that's really apparent in the West now.
I think so.
If you look
I
at,
think so. I think this crisis has reached rock bottom, as they say. You know.
Yeah, and it has to do with the rise of basically this complete plutocracy, this kind of complete
rule of the wealth,
exactly, and rule of money, and this kind of domination of the whole system by money
by
and
banks
and special interests.
Yes,
you
special
know.
Interests. Yes.
And when we're talking about special interests, obviously, when we talk about money, Zionism is right there.
Well, I mean, it's right there. I mean, right. They've all got those names, haven't they? You know, I don't want to go into that.
Right.
But
what I'm trying
to
say is that this doesn't
Lehman,
mean,
you know.
Right. What I'm trying to say is that this is together. You know, the fact that you would have a large, huge nation like the United States, 300 million people, not being able to pursue its own interests in the Middle East because of Israel or because of Al Saud.
Yes.
And again, we've talked about this many times, but it bears repeating, which is that, you know, it would be in the interests of the American people
to do something in the interest of America.
To have good relations with Iran, for example.
Well,
you know,
that would
to
be
actually,
nice.
You know, say, you know what, let's bury the hatchet, you know, let's start it. You know, we recognize that you had a revolution. You know, fine, you kicked the our guy out. That's okay. Yes. It's ancient history, as the Americans say. You know,
sure.
You know, let's get
Let
on with it.
Let bygones be bygones.
Let's get on with it.
Yeah.
You know, and so that would be in the interests of the American people. It would be in the interests of even the American elites.
Sure.
But unfortunately, you have, the Israel lobby. You have the Saudi lobby, which doesn't allow American elites to make that move.
Well, the other thing,
and they don't have the courage to tell foreigners
like the Israelis or the Saudis,
hey, back off. This is our national interest.
Sure, but their short-term interests are in congruence with each other, aren't they? Because
exactly.
Absolutely
correct. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's the key point which you were pointing out, which is that this is why the leadership can't do it, because they're only thinking short-term.
Yes.
They're thinking next elections. They're thinking Congress. They're thinking,
My pocket, basically.
Right.
Yes.
You know, how are we going to get the funding? They're thinking, media campaign. What's Fox News going to say? What's MSNBC going to say?
Exactly. It's all about image and so many other things.
Right, which is why we mentioned the example of Nixon.
That's right.
Nixon, being a conservative Republican anti-communist, gets up and goes to communist China.
Yeah.
And says, you know what, we're not going to recognize Taiwan,
sure.
the nationalist Chinese government, any longer. Mm. You know, it's a little island with a couple million versus, this massive...
Massive continent,
right.
Yes.
Yes, it's true. It helped the Americans in fighting the Soviets and creating a tripolar situation.
Sure.
In order to pit the Chinese against the Soviets. But still, here you had a guy who you would not expect to have been friendly with communists in communist China.
Sure.
And
but he was basically doing it in the American interest.
But
wasn't
he realized that this is in the American
interest
and he stood up against the people in his own party,
of course, who were deadly against it.
Right.
Yeah.
So this is what we talk about when we talk about leadership. Okay, you can call it. I don't know if I would call that moral leadership what Nixon did, but it was more. It was
more visionary.
It was a kind of leadership.
Yes. Yes.
You know what I mean?
Better than George Bush Jr.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Or if you look at somebody. I mean, look. I'm trying to just bring examples. There's a lot of you can. Make a lot of complaints about these examples. But you have somebody like Lyndon Johnson, who's from Texas, from the South. He's a Southern white, growing up in that segregation environment. And yet
he
stands up for civil rights.
He was hands up for civil rights,
right.
Yes.
So, these are things. And again, it might have not been easy for him to do that.
Sure.
In the
last minute or so, Dr. Turabi, just sum up for us, really, this crisis of leadership in the West.
Well, to sum it up, it's very simple.
Yes.
You have a system which is an Islamic system versus a secular system.
That's true.
In Islam, we say that the leader of a society has to himself be a moral person.
That's right.
Has to be a just person themselves in their own lives.
That's right.
Okay.
Personally, they must reflect that.
This is the difference.
Mm.
In secularism, they say if he is, that's good.
That's good.
But
that's
if he
bonus.
Isn't, yeah. But if he
doesn't,
if he isn't, he is.
Right.
That's basically what the difference is.
Sure.
You have a leadership system being presented in Islam in the time when the Prophet, peace be upon him, and the Imams are not present, which is the Walayat Faqih, the leadership of the
jurisprudent,
who is the one that is able to guide society as an expert in law. And law in Islam is not the law of the West. Law is a manifestation of divine right and wrong.
Divine right.
Okay, in Islam, when we talk about Sharia, when we talk about laws, fiqh, faqih, This is a manifestation of what is right and what is wrong, what is good and what is bad,
sure,
as defined by the Creator. So we need a person who's there to guide society on this path.
Sure. Thank you very much, Dr. Mahdi Torabi, for your valuable contribution on the program today. It certainly enlightened us a lot about what is the reality of the crisis of leadership in the West. But thanks very much for that. And it just leaves me to say for our audience, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you very much for listening to our program today. Goodbye.
Underwater Museum in Turkey is offering a unique opportunity to its visitors, diving back in time. The World War I era naval battle site turned into an underwater park on Turkey's Yapoli Peninsula, and it has recently opened its doors to the public. The area is known as the graveyard of the navies and includes dozens of shipwrecks from battles dating back to the early 20th century.
One of the most exciting things about diving is shipwrecks, of course. They remind you of the past, and it's like a time machine that takes you back to 1915.
The British Royal Battleship HMS Majestic is one of the first ships that divers see as they start their underwater journey. The vessel sank during the First World War and rests more than 24 meters below the ocean's surface, but it still remains intact. Remains of 14 British, French, and Australian warships are over there. Museum officials say they want the site to become a new hub for divers who wish to explore historical events.
Russia has sent an actress and a director to space to make the world's first movie in orbit. The crew blasted off from Kazakhstan for the International Space Station along with a cosmonaut and successfully reached the orbit. They spent 4 months on preparation for the flight. After 12 days in space, they will return to Earth. The movie, named Challenge, is about a doctor who goes to the space station to treat an astronaut with a heart ailment. Russian officials say the project will help burnish the nation's space glory. Australian scientists have developed artificial structures that act as a much-needed habitat for marine life.
It's extremely exciting because we have seen a total of more than 90 species colonizing these diverse panels, and we see 30 to 40% more species on the panels in the living seawalls than on the unmodified parts of the seawall, so the seawalls with no panels. So that's extremely exciting, and really gives us confidence to scale this up to other environments and other artificial structures.
The project has installed over 1,000 artificially designed panels onto seawalls in Sydney. These craggy concrete panels are 3D printed and designed to last for at least 20 years. Only a short time after installation, they turned into a cozy new home for the fish, crustaceans, and other marine life.
So we have more fish in Sydney Harbour than we have in the entire UK coast. So we have more than 500 species of fish in the harbor, so that's quite impressive. But what we notice is that urbanization and the human settling, especially towards the coast, has a lot of impacts on this amazing marine environment, and that's what we are trying to mitigate a bit with the living seawalls by attaching these panels that have that mimic natural features such as rocky shores and rock pools and crevices and nooks and crannies.
After becoming popular in Australia, the panels were also installed in Wales and Singapore. The scientists say since the installation of these panels, the quality of Sydney's harbour water has improved. They hope coastal structures built in the future would be ecologically sustainable, designed not only for humans, but for nature. The Greek Postal Service has come up with an innovative idea to speed up the mail sorting process, not by humans, but a fleet of robots. 55 tiny yellow robots powered by artificial intelligence are helping employees in Hellenic Post Sorting Center. They scan postal codes to identify the bundle's destination, weigh the parcels, and put them in related platforms. The program aims to handle increasing number of packages from online shopping, especially during the pandemic.
The end result is a threefold increase in sorting speed of parcels, ensuring next day delivery for our customers. These autonomous mobile robots are energy efficient, thus directly reducing the energy consumption of the sorting process, and that way allowing us to take a greener approach to operations.
According to the company, up to 80% of mail sorting has been passed to the four-wheeled robots. Each day, these little machines manage around 168,000 packages weighing up to 15 kilograms. Every 4 hours, they need recharging, which takes 5 minutes.
Plastic pollution has become one of the most pressing environmental issues as disposable products overwhelm the world's ability to deal with them. Indonesian activists have come up with an idea to convince people to rethink their habits and say no to single-use bags and bottles. Environmentalists have created a museum made entirely from plastic waste in the town of Gresing in East Java. It took them 3 months to collect used plastic items, ranging from bottles and bags to sachets and straws. They were all assembled from polluted rivers and beaches. The centerpiece of this museum is a statue whose skirt is made from single-use sachets of household items. The museum has become a popular location for selfies and has received more than 400 visitors since it opened last month.
I will definitely change my life habits. For example, like when I go to the market or to a grocery store that provides a plastic bag, I will switch to a tote bag. And when I buy a drink, I will use a tumbler.
Environmentalists say the plan behind the exhibition was to send a message about the world's worsening ocean plastic crisis. The plastic problem is particularly acute in Indonesia, a nation that ranks second only behind China for its volume of plastics that end up in the seas.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trendy news, and more from every corner of the world.
People around the world celebrate the changing seasons in different ways. In the U.S., an annual pumpkin contest is held to kick off the fall season. Each year, farmers and vegetable enthusiasts from across the U.S. gather in New England for the competition. Anyone bringing the largest homegrown pumpkin gets the prize. This year, a man from Abington, Connecticut, got the prize for his pumpkin weighing more than 2,000 pounds. Alex Noel explains how he worked hard to produce that giant pumpkin.
A nearly unlimited amount of work goes into producing a 2,000-pound-plus pumpkin. I put about 1,000 hours a season into 2 to 3 giant pumpkins, and you're lucky. out there watering, fertilizing, keeping excess water off if it's too rainy, which it was this year, spraying insecticides, spraying fungicides, pruning, training vines, dropping up leaves at the end of the season, putting blankets on when it's cold out, heating cables, fans. I mean, the list goes on and on.
The New England Giant Pumpkin Way Off began at the Tufts Field Fair in 1984. That year, the winner showcased a pumpkin weighing 196 kilograms. The Way Off has received worldwide recognition, too. Syria's ancient city of Aleppo seems getting a taste of normalcy amid reconstruction efforts and the war-ravaged city. A Syrian historian has also been contributing to make the city regain its lost glory. Ala al-Sayed is working to faithfully restore the lost sections of Aleppo's old city. For that, he is using documents and clippings he himself saved during the early years of the conflict. He says he came up with the idea to digitalize those documents in 2013. Then he embarked on organizing newspapers, books, and pamphlets while scanning each one to add to his digital library. Following the liberation of Aleppo, Ala came back to the city and started renovating historic places which are on the World Heritage List.
The North Dublin suburb of Howth has a new highly efficient firefighting crew. The group has 25 members, but none of them are human.
Howth was targeted by a lot of fire, and so there's a lot of gorse here, and it's prone, it's very flammable. The goats, on the other hand, love gorse, so it's a win-win in that sense. I suppose the project also focuses on the old Irish goat, defining their role as a functional biodiversity crew. They're a hard-working crew. They're up for the job, they're keen to do it. It also instills key conservation grazing principles to tackle fire prevention and habitat management and the control of invasive species. So it's the old Irish ladies that have a job to do here and are well able to do it.
The goats graze eagerly on the ample gorse bushes, which are highly inflammable and cause blazes in hot weather. The local council hopes their deployment will make Howth less susceptible to wildfires. Conservationists also hope that the project will contribute to the survival of the old Irish goats, which almost went extinct in the last century. Each member of the herd has a box around their neck with a built-in GPS device. If the goats stray too far, the gadget will ping and let the owner know.
Five Siberian tiger cubs born in a South Korean zoo have made their first public debut. The cubs were born at Everland Theme Park in Yongin in late June. Their birth brought joy and hope to wildlife enthusiasts as they are listed as endangered species. Zookeepers say it's unusual for Siberian tigers to give birth to five babies at once. South Korean people selected the cubs' names through an online vote. Many exotic fruit plants need the tropical climate to grow, but a Syrian is producing nearly 100 types of tropical fruits at his backyard in a coastal city of Tartus. Mohammed Hassan's passion for agriculture is to the extent that he left his job in media to build a farm. He managed to create a tropical environment at his compound, and that was the reason behind his success in growing fruits that are rare in many parts of the world. In fact, he has turned his farm into what he likes to be described as a tropical cave.
I came across the world of tropical fruits as some of them existed here. Many immigrants also helped me on this path. They bought me special varieties from India, South America, the Caribbean and other countries, even China. Currently, we grow 93 types of fruits.
Hassan's success has encouraged other Tartus residents to create their own farms. The government is also assisting Hassan with his unique business. His farm is now open to tourists and visitors where they can taste the products. Hassan says he has bigger plans for the future and is thinking about using his tropical environment to raise and breed rainforest animals. In Brazil, paleontologists have discovered the fossilized remains of a dinosaur that lived roughly 70 million years ago.
It's a bipedal dinosaur with short arms, around 5 meters long, and it was at the top of the food chain in the period in which it lived. It was the predator at the time.
Paleontologists say the fossil suggests a dinosaur species known as Kurupi itata was a meat eater. They found the ancient predator's remains at one of Brazil's richest sites for dinosaur findings in the city of Sao Paulo. The first piece of Kurupi itata's fossil was unearthed during an excavation work in 2002. Until the completion of the research, a model of this species would be on display at Monte Alto's Museum of Paleontology. Experts believe the discovery would help scientists better understand paleontology on Brazilian lands. Most of us know the feeling of being moved by a work of art. A Kosovo artist tries to make us understand a form of political discourse through a mosaic of outgoing German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Alkent Pajogo has made a Merkel mosaic from seeds. The artist says he wished to thank the German leader for having been an example for all the women of the world. He says his work is also a tribute to the towering lady for the support she had given to his country, which declared its independence in 2008. Pajago was doing his work on the same day Germans were voting in the general elections to choose a successor to Merkel. Alkan Pajago holds 2 Guinness World Records for his giant mosaics made with seeds.
Technology plays an important role in our daily lives. This time, a French company has introduced a device to help the visually impaired to avoid obstacles. The smart electronic device detects obstacles and warns users with a beep. People with vision loss can install it on the top of their canes and receive information through headphones. The gadget helps people to dodge barriers on the ground and above that, for example, the open door of a truck.
If you hear the sound to the right, it means that the obstacle is on the right. If it is straight ahead, the obstacles are in front of you. So you change course according to what you hear. If you hear an obstacle to the left, you go to the right, and this way you can go around the obstacle.
The device costs around $2,300 and is now being used by hundreds of people in Belgium, France, Germany, Italy, and Switzerland.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pit.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamadi.
Islamadi.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Youth Station. Choo choo ka choo. It's the Youth Station for you. Here in the studio today, we have with us myself, Mudathar.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Brothers and sisters, welcome to Youth Station. I'm Zainab.
What percentage of Islam is in Muslims' lifestyle?
Do you consider yourself as a practicing Muslim?
Yeah. What about you?
Yes.
Yeah. Alhamdulillah.
Yes, yes, yes.
Alhamdulillah.
Yes. Alhamdulillah. Rabbil alamin.
Thank God.
Yeah, definitely.
We are practicing Muslims. I think that's the least we can say about ourselves.
Yeah.
The most that we can say about ourselves.
But yeah, when you look around, you see some people who are not practicing Islam. Mm.
What does practicing Islam mean, though? Is it just about praying and fasting and doing Hajj and praying your homes?
I think to an extent, yes.
Only?
Yeah.
Oh, come on. There's that literal hadith from Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam. His Eminence says, don't look at how long the ruku' and sujood is. Rather, look at how they interact with others, how trustworthy they are, how honest, how kind.
Yeah, I mean, but if they're not trustworthy, then they're actually lying, which means that they're telling a sin, which they're doing a sin, which
exactly.
Means that they're
not practicing. I'm saying that, sure, salat is the pillar of religion, right? And as the hadith states, if it's accepted, the rest are accepted. If it's not accepted, the rest won't be accepted either, mm-hmm. right? But we have to understand that if someone does observe salat, right, but is a jerk in society, right, it means that, and being a jerk is not accepted by God, right?
Yeah.
It means that their salat wasn't accepted.
Okay.
And it led to them being a jerk. Right?
Yeah. Because and salah is the fulcrum.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Tanha an al fahsha'i wal munkar.
Yeah. It protects you from indecencies and vulgarity.
Exactly.
Voice, yeah.
Right? So I'm saying that we can't necessarily say just because a person prays and fasts or a woman wears hijab that they have a high percentage of Islam in their lives. That's what I'm trying to say. But
at the same time, I mean, Islam means to submit. I mean, they're practicing all those basic rules.
Why
right?
are they doing it? Cleanliness is part of faith.
Oh, yeah, I completely forgot
and
about
you know,
that.
Dude, like, everything about what you're doing is non-Islamic. It's against Sunnah, it's against the Quran, it's against everything. No, I don't want to say, why do you think just because you pray and you fast, you're going to go to heaven? I ain't here to judge.
Mm.
But I'm saying that, why do you think it's all about just praying and fasting? Right?
Mm.
Smelling good isn't necessarily as important as praying. Rasulullah never said changing your socks at the pillar of religion, mm. right? Mm. He said salat is. But it's these little details.
A lot of what the prophets and imams did was trying to get us to become more intellectual.
Oui.
The more intellectual somebody is, they will just naturally want to keep clean. They will naturally want to clothe themselves. They'll naturally want to be polite with others.
And smell nice.
A lot of people are practicing the deen without any intellectual introspection.
Exactly.
This is a beautiful hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam. He says, there is no goodness in the deen except that which you contemplate over. I've been looking for that hadith my whole life, I'm telling
exactly,
you.
Exactly, right?
Yeah. Hold that thought. The train is taking a short break.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
We talked about how it's uncool to do taqleed, to mimic, to imitate our religion. Unless, like, in ahkam,
yeah.
right? We downright, well, I don't have the time to go study for years and years and years and acquire ijtihad
mm.
and know all the specific rules regarding yeah. all the obligatory acts.
But
exactly.
even in akhlaq, you can do taqleed to a
from
certain
Rasulullah.
Extent. From the Holy Prophet, from the Ahlul Bayt.
Yeah, by taqleed, I mean that we copy our parents because they prayed and fasted, right? That's why we did not come to an intellectual understanding of those acts. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
We copy our parents because they brush their teeth. Why is it that children that after they've grown up and they've become exposed to the society and they hang out with perhaps not the right people, they stop fasting, they stop praying, they sometimes consume stuff that
because
they're not supposed to.
Yeah. They didn't have an intellectual foundation
exactly.
for following those things in the first
yeah.
place.
But there wasn't enough Islam.
Yeah. Have you seen I Am Legend?
No.
I Am Legend, Will Smith. You have seen it.
I've watched the trailer. I've read about it.
They're good enough. It's a guy who's just completely alone, right? It's actually
Apocalypse.
Based on a novel. A zombie, whatever. But he
is completely...
I thought
they were vampires.
Huh?
I thought they were vampires.
They are... It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. The point is that he is completely alone. There are no other human beings
around
him.
But he has a doggo,
him.
Right?
It's not a good feel. It's just... Don't watch it. It's just... It's rubbish.
Why is it miserable?
They made the real version. They followed the book. And the book says that, you know... He eventually realizes that all of those vampires that he was fighting were actually, they'd gained a consciousness of their own. So he is actually the monster now. Jeez. That was what the book said.
I'm not going to watch it because the dog dies. Spoiler alert.
Yeah, the dog dies.
All right, so but what happens in the legend?
They've showed this to an American audience, and apparently the audience just could not intellectually comprehend that the hero is the bad guy in the end. Oh, no. So they had to change the whole ending, and the new ending is just rubbish.
Okay. So, and the point is?
The point is that if we imagine ourselves in the scenario of the hero of that tale who is completely alone, would you still pray Salah? That would answer so much for you. Would you still pray Salah? Would you still do these du'as?
Would you?
Hey.
Would
that's
you?
That's a personal question. Would you?
Yeah, because what else am I going to do?
Survive? But, okay, inshallah, right, we do. But that answers the question. Are we really Muslims? How much of Islam have we really implemented in ourselves?
Exactly.
How much of it is just because of our circumstances? I'm in this place, I'm in an Islamic
country,
I'm not
bad.
In an Islamic country. Some people even adopt the hijab, for example, for the daughters in their family. You look at the sons in the family, they're completely outrageous.
Exactly.
They follow, like, none of Islam. But you girls, you have to wear hijab. Why?
Hijab.
It's not because of Islam. It's not because Allah wants this.
Tradition
it's because
and culture.
As a man of the house, I need to control these ladies, because if the guys go and do something bad, nobody really cares. Mm-hmm. Society doesn't even look bat an eyelid, right? But if the girls go bad,
everyone loses.
Oh my God, my reputation has gone down the drain. That's why we're really doing it. And
exactly.
We have to ask ourselves, is that why we're implementing Islam?
That's the question we constantly need to ask ourselves. Why are we doing it? Flashback, throwback to when I asked you whether you consider yourself a practicing Muslim.
That was last episode.
Yeah, but you said yes, right? To a certain extent.
Yeah, I'm a practicing
why?
Muslim.
Why?
I'm a proud practicing
why?
Muslim. Why? Why? If I say, oh, because Allah wants me to, because that's the right answer. That's why we should be following Islam, because it pleases Allah. I'll find out on the day of judgment myself.
Because it just makes sense to me, right?
Yeah.
At this point in my life where I am, this makes sense.
What? We have a short break to go to? Welcome back. We've been talking about what percentage of Islam is in Muslims' lifestyle.
Practicing Islam.
What? But then if your life changes, then no.
I don't know until then. Maybe it will change for the worse.
God
maybe
protect
it will
us.
Change
See,
it for the
really
better.
It's very complicated. Actually, look, the reality is this. And lots of youths ask this kind of question, right? They say, my best friend, John, you know, he's not a Muslim. He doesn't really believe in God, but he's really nice because he gave me a PlayStation game, you know? Youths have these kinds of questions,
yeah.
And even when we haven't matured out of them, even when we grow into later life as well, I've had women, like grown women, mothers, coming and asking the same question. Well, what about Mrs. Findlay down the road? She's not a bad person. Is she going to burn in hell just because she didn't say La ilaha illallah?
It depends.
I don't believe in that. Right.
It honestly depends.
It does depend.
Or, you know, often you see a lot of people who are totally anti-religion, especially in media, but they're so charitable and they're so helpful and they're so giving and they're so honest.
At the same time, you see somebody like Bill Gates or something, and they're giving, like, they have a whole foundation, they're giving loads and loads of charity, and you think to yourself, well, they've given much more charity than I ever will, therefore they're a much better person, and...
Maybe they are.
Maybe they
are.
And Allah
compensated for the likes of Bill Gates. Come on, he's a cajillionaire.
Yeah. Let's say that you don't know. In fact, this is the reality. You don't know. You
exactly.
don't even know where
yes.
you are.
Yes,
okay,
yes,
you
yes,
don't.
Yes.
You can try to be a Muslim or a Mu'min or a Shia or whatever. Try to be. But do you know what you really are? No, you don't. Only on the Day of Judgment will you know. And that same person who was preaching to you. Right, that so-called scholar. There is a hadith that says when a person goes on the Day of Judgment and, you know, he's risen in a good good form, and, you know, he's going to be given good deeds, and, you know, his good deeds are coming back to him now. He's going to see that scholar who preached to him going towards the hellfire.
Oh, no.
And he's going to say to him, how can you be going to the hellfire?
You taught me this.
And the scholar will say, yes, I taught you, but I never applied any myself.
Oh, my God. Okay? God forbid.
There are many, many good people in the world who you think are good. Over there, you're going to see that they are very, very bad.
You know, bad. See, and this is where it
and
comes...
And the vice versa as well.
Exactly.
The opposite is true as well.
Thus,
very, very... You might see the nastiest people, right?
Yeah.
He's a drug addict. I don't know. He's, like, got wild hair, and he's, like, that guy. But then on the Day of Judgment, he could be really good, and
Allah
you don't know.
Allah could cut him,
right?
You know,
why? Because he's tried his hardest, and that's the best he could do.
That's life
poor
circumstances
guy.
For him. And thus enters Don't Judge Anyone.
No.
I firmly believe we're not allowed to judge. Not in the whole, like, okay, let anyone, I'm going to do whatever I want, and I am going to consider myself immune to all forms of criticism because only God can judge me. That's not what I mean. I can judge for myself, right, who I want and do not want in my life. You know, whose energy do I appreciate and whose vibe do I find totally toxic for myself.
If you want to know a person's deen, look at his friends.
Exactly. Look at the people he hangs out with. But also, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam said to Malik al-Ashtar that if you see someone sinning at night, don't look at them in the same eyes tomorrow morning because they might have repented throughout the night and you didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Only Allah knows a person's background, their history, their potential, their capacity, their intentions.
I think, would this make sense? Don't judge the batin. Don't judge what is inside. You don't know what's inside.
Yeah.
You don't know the entire world that's going on behind the scenes. But you need to judge the exterior.
The action itself.
Right? The action itself.
Is
say,
wrong.
This is wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
This thing which this so-and-so person is doing
is
wrong.
But yeah. I can't judge whether they will or will not go to hell.
They might be in a better place than we
are. Exactly. You know, but really, honestly, maybe they were genuinely ignorant or abused in some form or way.
There's lots
and
of people
yeah.
who are abused, and so they
in the name
abusers.
Of religion, and they totally just went berserk. And honestly, I don't blame them. And that's all the time we have for today's episode.
We hope that you enjoyed listening to this train of thought with myself and with Sister Zainab Barakat.
Thank you so much, you guys, for being with us on today's episode of Youth Station. Until another salam and greeting, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because you are the one I call Creator, my Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you, in weakness I am braver, my defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance, aware when I need you, the light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness. And my love is strong because you are the one I call Creator, my Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.